Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. So I've got a really great episode for you guys. We did a crossover episode of Andrew Yang and myself. So Yang Speaks meets The Realignment podcast. It was really an incredible conversation with Andrew Yang, who is somebody who, you know, many of you might even know, really helped me get Rising off the ground with Crystal. Our first interviews with Andrew on our YouTube channel were some of the first ways that so many of you found us. He was such an interesting figure for me throughout the Democratic primary, and I tracked his work so closely. You know, we tangled a few times on trade and automation, and I broke down many of his plans and really what he means to the Asian American community and really what he means to political norms writ large. So it was incredible, you know, kind of a year almost after that experience, actually maybe more than a year now, that I got to sit down with him for this podcast in the light of all of the crazy things that have happened in our society. I mean, as he mentions there, UBI is at like a 50% approval rating now, which is just absolutely insane if you look back at some of the policy coverage from during the Democratic primary election. There's no question that he changed politics forever, which is something that I said over and over again during that primary campaign. And we really got into it on everything from journalism to tech to the future of politics, the future of the Democratic Party, the future of the Republican Party, and most importantly, what you all wanted to know, which is why does he support Joe Biden in the first place, given his politics. But before that, Marshall, I understand we have a realignment question.
Well, yeah, before we even dive into that, it was funny to listen to this episode as a producer rather than as a co-host. I think this is the most time anyone has said dude or man back and forth on a podcast. It's really interesting how comfortable two of you are together. And that's something that I think is interesting. If we think of who are the politicians who are going to succeed in these more open formats, you can't fake that. You can't fake being comfortable with a person who's asking you tough questions, but still it's sort of friendly. So that was just good to hear. But yes, to anyone who is new here, every week we do realignment questions. We answer anything or whatever. Actually, not anything. Whoever sent us some weird Jeffrey Epstein attachment, I am not kidding, this really happened, we are not going to respond to that question. So everything except weird...
Wait. Speak for yourself, because I'll respond as long as they leave a 5-star review, Marshall.
Well, funnily enough, there wasn't a 5-star review this time, and it was just weird stuff. So there were 2 strikes okay. From my perspective there. Right. So to what we actually do here then, if you send us a 5-star review with a screenshot, or you leave us your question in the review itself, we will answer it live on the air. We are going to hit 1,000 reviews by the election. It annoys some people. We're going to make it. So on to this week's question. Both of you have stressed that your priorities have been meeting the needs of the working class and the majority of the American population. Given Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan and his plans to raise the corporate tax rate and the pressure from the progressive wing of the party to be harder on big tech, it seems like the Democratic Party is actually a better advocate for many of your positions. So, why are you guys still aligned with the Republican Party besides being annoyed by the politics of the woke left? Also, he wants a mug. So, Eric, we will get you a mug along with answering your question. Sagar, what do you think?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, Marshall. And actually, there's a very simple answer, actually, from Joe Biden himself. He responded to the Washington Post fact checker, emphatically declaring that not a single person making less than $400,000 a year in America will have their taxes raised, not just in their marginal tax rate, but in everything, tax interest deduction, retirement accounts, an ironclad pledge. Why did he make that pledge, Marshall? Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton pledged not to raise taxes on anyone making over $250,000 a year. So why did he cut out the top 5% of some of the wealthiest Americans in this country? And there's a reason for that, which is that is the realignment that Biden and his party have chosen. They have chosen to cater to try and realign this party around formerly upper middle class Republican voters who, for a long time, voted for the GOP based upon tax policy, but for a variety of reasons, cosmopolitanism, the education, whatever, you want to blame it, which is those people are cultural liberals and they have been for a long time. All Biden is doing is completing the circle, cultural liberalism with their preferred tax policy. So in the long run, that is the path that I expect the Democratic Party to take under Joe Biden if he does win the presidency. And as for the progressive left, ultimately, as we saw during the coronavirus shutdowns and the debates over the bailouts, is they really don't even have any power within their own caucus.
Yeah, and this is helpful because I appreciate the question, Eric. I hope there hasn't been this sort of sense that Sagar and my argument is that you have to be a Republican or you have to be a conservative to care about these issues, because that's very hacky. And it's pretty clear from both of our angles that there's a variety of things in both parties that are actually really screwed up and aren't going to actually address these issues properly. So the way to think about these issues is structurally. That's something that we really want to sort of think about. And it's actually, frankly, something that the left does a lot better than the right does, which is if we look at the two parties right now, if we look at our critique of the American political system, if we look at the critique of the way economic power is structured, if we look at the way the culture is set up, if we look at the way that tech companies are run, we should recognize that most of these institutions are actually dominated by the center left. So if you are someone who finds yourself questioning what the status quo looks like in this country, well, maybe you should consider whether or not aligning yourself with the actual institution that runs that status quo, whether that's going to be an effective means for you. And look, it could be that the Republican Party isn't actually the institution that actually does that. Maybe it could be the Republican Party is doomed to be a minority party that can't win popular vote elections. That, to me, doesn't seem to be something that could be possible forever. It doesn't seem to me to be that California could be a blue state forever. So maybe something else will simply come too. So we just think that you should really think about this thing structurally. And if you think about it that way, it's pretty clear that just aligning with Democrats, along with everyone else and their cousin, would not actually help the change that we actually want. So look, we know what you guys are here for. You're here for the conversation with Andrew Yang. So right before we dive into that, a quick shout out to our sponsor, Lincoln Network, doing incredible work, really helping us focus on the tech and policy issues, like my episode of Jacob Hellberg last week about China and Silicon Valley and Zoom and TikTok. Check that out if you didn't get a chance to listen. But on to the episode.
Let's dive in. I guess you can introduce me or I can introduce you, however you want me to do it, since it's on both of our platforms.
It's yet another crossover.
Yeah.
The great Sagar and Jetty from the Hill is going to be on Yang Speaks, and I'm going to be on The Realignment.
That's right. So thank you, Andrew, so much for joining the podcast. Really appreciate it, man.
Appreciate you. I thought you were young. I didn't realize you were as young as you are.
Well, you're a young man. You know, you're a young man.
I'm not young like you, man. I mean, you're freaking late 20s. Yeah. That's like a whole different metabolism. That's like, I can just treat my body however I like. You can stay up to all hours. You can put anything you want in your body. You can court injury and know that you'll bounce back. So I appreciate you lumping me in with yourself in that category. But I remember my late 20s, and there's a difference.
So, Andrew, tell me about your mid... Let's start there, actually. Tell me about your mid-20s. Like, how did you ideologically kind of come to where you are right now? Because, you know, just quick context, like on my podcast, and I know we have some similar missions here, but mine is really just looking at the realignment in American politics. You've always kind of embodied that, you know, huge amount of crossover with Trump voters and more. And the number one question I often get, and that's one of the one I wanted to hear from you, is how did you kind of come to see what was happening in this country? You wrote your book before, obviously you ran for your candidacy, but how many years before that did you kind of see that, you know, the fourth industrial revolution kind of happening before your eyes?
Well, it took a lot of walking around the country over the last now, gosh, 9 years or so. But I used to compare it to the parable of the blind man and the elephant, where you ask the blind man, what does an elephant look like? And then one of them's holding the trunk and is like, a big, thick snake. And another one's touching the leg and saying, like, a tree trunk. So in my case, I spent 7 years traveling the country for an organization that I started, Venture for America, that took me to Detroit, Cleveland, Baltimore, St. Louis, Birmingham, New Orleans, and cities around the country. And I saw the aftermath of automation of manufacturing jobs. And it was like a sledgehammer. I was walking around these places being like, wow, this place is not doing well. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that it's like, why is it that we don't seem to be having like an honest grappling with what it means to decimate manufacturing communities to this degree. So I'm an entrepreneur and a practical type. So for me, you know, the interesting trajectory I've had is that you try and solve one problem and then it leads you to another problem and then it leads you to another problem. So for me, the problem I was trying to solve for 7 years was that we weren't creating enough new businesses and entrepreneurship and business growth and job growth in communities around the country. And then I realized that the problems were much bigger and deeper. But certainly, Andrew Yang in his late 20s was not thinking any of this. Andrew Yang in his late 20s was just, you know, trying to get a date. So there wasn't a lot of deep thought going on in my head at that time, I don't think.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting and what captured so much interest about your candidacy and more was you talk about it in terms of the fourth industrial revolution. Obviously, you know, I've interviewed you in the past and you obviously understand some of the deeper, I mean, obviously you did the math. But you also spoke about it in a very visceral way. So when you were traveling those places and you're talking to these people, how did it come through, like, in their stories? Because something that I've always kind of come to understand is that elite economists and many others will try to explain phenomena away by being like, no, your job is gone, but you're better off because of X. And that when you actually talk to real voters and people who have been, you know, affected by automation, trade policy, or loss of manufacturing, they know exactly why they lost their job and the macro force that it kind of brought about. So is that something that you saw, like, whenever you were traveling?
Yeah, they did know what happened, particularly in a place like Detroit, where the urban center emptied out for the most part and the population drained away. And they know that it was a combination of globalization and trade deals and offshoring and also the automation of many of their traditional manufacturing jobs. So they know. And I studied economics, so I understand the theory behind it. You know, like, oh, comparative advantage, you'll be fine. Or, you know, you'll learn how to do something that's higher value add. But then you go there and that stuff just seems farcical. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. You go there.
Right.
And there was a disconnect that I struggled with, and then Trump won in 2016. I started Venture of America in 2011, so I'd been doing that work for 5 years, and then Trump wins, and then I'm like, okay, this is much deeper and nastier, and we're still not being honest about it somehow. So that was what drove me. But I am very interested in trying to figure out the genesis of my approach, in part because, like, I went to Brown University, which most people know, that's like a very liberal college. You know, I've been an operator and entrepreneur for 20 years or so. And, you know, they're just like facts on the ground that you have to deal with. And if you tell yourself a nonsense story and you're running a private company, you're going to fail.
You know? Yes, right.
Like, it's... you know, it's inevitable. And so, you know, I like to think I just traffic in as close a version to reality as I can find, because if you're operating from reality, then you're more likely to be successful. And one of the frustrations I found, Sagar, is that, like, there's not a whole lot of trafficking in reality that's going on right now. And it's going to destroy us because we have this increasingly inchoate set of arguments. One thing that someone said to me, it was Lawrence Lessig, who said to me that we live in a vetocracy right now where I can't get anything done, but I can keep you from getting anything done.
Right.
And so there's a lot of negative power going on. And we're in an era of unprecedented change. And so if you freeze government and say no one can get anything done, then you wind up with problems that just get bigger and bigger, and you become more and more behind the curve and out of date.
I think that's a really profound point that you're making there, Andrew, because the main thing that you're observing is that we can stop things from other getting done. And like I was saying, like, I generally find the whole shtick about businessmen trying to run the country that way as pretty hokey, because it's like, well, no, actually, like, a nation state is not a business and all that. But the one thing where I think it absolutely does apply is to your point is that if you do something which is totally delusional, you generally, your business should fail. Like, there should be at least some sort of incentive. Theoretically, that's in democracy. Like, voters should vote you out if you do fail. And yet, we've kind of come to a system where you have both parties, which are invested very much in an ideology, which has failed. You know, the fourth industrial revolution, as you call it, didn't really just occur out of nowhere. How did we get to that point? How do you think that the political system itself got broken to the point where it's generally impervious to the will of actual voters?
I'm digging into this more and more, Sagar, which is why are we so detached from our leaders or vice versa? And there are all of these layers between the people and our policymakers at this point. And you can go through them successively. I mean, number one is if an ordinary person tries to run for office, they have no chance of doing so because they're going to need $1 million, and the average human being is not going to be able to go get $1 million to try and unseat the incumbent. And then they're often in a district where it's safe red or safe blue, so your only option is to primary the incumbent, which itself has some obstacles. If you're fortunate enough to actually get into office, then you're in a constant fundraising hamster wheel where you're just constantly calling folks and dialing for dollars. And then the system serves as your moat where you're like, okay, now if I dial for dollars diligently, I now have $1 million moat between me and anyone who's going to challenge me. You have this entire layer of corporate interest that then get in your ear and tell you what they think you should do. And when you're in DC, they're the only people that you'll actually talk to. There was an Onion headline that was funny. It was, the American people should hire our own lobbyist to represent us on Capitol Hill. Yeah, and you laugh, but I was like, that's a pretty good idea. We should just have a lobbyist being like, you know what Americans think? Because at this point, you have a lobbyist for every other major trade group or set of industries is telling you what they think. And then you get into Congress and your incentives are not to reach across the aisle and get anything done because, you know, you might be in a seat where it's not serving the general public that is in your political interest. It's just to try and keep yourself from getting primaried because of the way the districts have been drawn. So your job isn't necessarily to solve the work of the public or solve the problems of the public and do the people's work. It's to raise enough money so you never lose, to avoid getting primaried, to avoid any scandal. So don't do anything that's going to put you into harm's way. You know, I guess some of them can't pull that one off. And then to get your face on cable news so you can build a better public profile and then maybe try and advance yourself politically. And one of the things I was for on the campaign trail was for earmarks because they helped people reach across the aisle and get deals done. And mm-hmm. So if I wanted to try and pass this law, and then you said, look, I can get on board with this law if you, you know, help fund my bridge or museum or whatever it is, I think that's fine. You know, and then people could look at it and say, that bridge and museum's a waste. It's like, is it really? I mean, you know, someone wanted it. Mm-hmm. Like your member of Congress thought it was a good idea. So there are these fundamental structural problems that keep legislators from caring what we think. But a big part of it, Sagar, is the media, where the media is not really holding anyone accountable to a uniform set of facts anymore. There's just this back and forth news of the day and the rise and fall of mini characters so that there's like an increased level of both confusion and despair among the average American. And so a lot of Americans just check out politics altogether and say, well, this is a waste of time.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you know, I'm obsessed with this study from the Knight Foundation called like the 100 million project. And they look at the 100 million people in America who don't vote and why they don't vote. It's like a broad cross section. And the number one reason why is apathy with the political system. They have no faith in all political institutions, in business institutions, in all of the general institutions of American life. So when they look at voting, I mean, I love this. I think there was a story from 2016 from a barbershop in Milwaukee, a black barbershop, and they actually went in and people said, you know, I didn't vote and I don't really feel bad about it, you know, because they were asked specifically, like, you were a Democrat. You could have put Hillary over the edge. And they just said, you know, this is something that Chris Arnotti and his work has dug into, something we've had on our podcast. You focus in there on the media, and I know you're really into, as I am as well, kind of what the future of media might look like. And I'm really fascinated, Andrew, because you came up, I mean, you got popular on independent media, Joe Rogan, on my show, and many other different places across the internet, but now you're kind of in the belly of the beast.
It was Joe down here and you up here.
Right, of course. I mean, of course. Yeah, yeah. As a fellow Rogan guest, you know, I'm joking. I mean, but now you're in the belly of the beast. You're on CNN. You're on these CNN kind of post-election panels. So just talk to us about that. Like, you are someone who looks very much at future of the media, how it can be solved. Also, kind of working within CNN. What's that like?
Well, I certainly went through this media ringer, and I appreciate you and Crystal and folks like Joe and Sam Harris and so many others, Breakfast Club, that had me on when I was not as mainstream, I suppose, and just heard me out and talked about my campaign. Now being on CNN, like, I have more insight into the goods and bads of how the media works. And I've been honest saying, look, for me, being on CNN, I think, is very positive because it helps just get my face and voice in front of Americans in a way that can help advance our goals and ideas. And I will say, being on CNN, I have never gotten any notes in terms of, hey, maybe you should try and make this point, or feedback being like, hey, that point was not great. Or go down this direction. So, you know, on that level, it's quite positive. But I also see that there are incentives wrapped up in the medium that end up driving coverage in particular ways, and that the medium doesn't allow for particular types of conversations or ideas to get out that might not fit into the rhythm of a 5-minute cable news hit that in those news hits comprise the vast majority of the coverage, because the thought is that, well, if you're a TV audience, like, you need to keep things snappy and then kind of get in and out and maybe have like graphic and video and some other stuff. So let's just say that, you know, being part of the media is just fueling my desire to try to change the incentives in ways that'll make it work better for more Americans. And I say this in particular about the 1,000+ local newspapers that went out of business. So are there issues with cable news? Yes, major issues. But at least they exist. You know, if you have no local paper, it's very hard to vote on what's going on in your town. And so what's going on in media is a microcosm of what is going wrong in American life, which is just the market runs everything. And so if you're like, post office doesn't make money, fuck the post office. You know, like, that local paper didn't make money anymore. Get rid of it. It's like, well, maybe that local paper actually had some value to the people in that town beyond the fact that it made money as a private concern. So I'm after it in a big way, Sagar, because to me, we have to fix democracy. And it's going to be difficult to fix democracy if you don't have certain types of functioning media organizations.
Yeah, and let's talk about the incentives there, because we've talked a lot here on, you know, on my podcast just about the way that the media business is changing. You know, you have, first you had the click ad revenue model. Of course, there was a monopoly on classified ads. Now that's gone with Facebook, Google, and so much more. I actually use a line all the time that I think you said on my show, which is that the internet naturally selects for monopolies. Like, nobody wants to use the fourth worst Google, the second best Facebook, or whatever. But if we're going to live within that system with realities, and I've always appreciated that, you're fair, right? That, you know, people don't really want to use multiple Facebooks or multiple Googles. If we're going to live in that world, what do we do with media? So, because how do we actually make it so, because you don't want government subsidized local news either. I mean, that, you know, we're talking about earmarks and pork. Like,
I actually do want, and this is where we disagree. I think government subsidized local news.
Yeah. But how would you protect it? How would you protect it from, you know, legislators who are using it as a bargaining chip? Like, if you look at what's happening right now with Voice of America and the Global News agency, there have been all these accusations like, oh, Trump put in this person, and, you know, even though this person has been selected by Congress. So if we were going to fund it, like, what are the ways that we could do it while keeping it independent with the essential role that media has, and then also protecting it from political influence? Is it even possible?
I think it is possible, and I think that there are a few different parties that need to be part of it. Number one is government. Number two is nonprofits and NGOs, And then number three are the media companies. And I think there's a way you can fund it where, let's say hypothetically you said, guess what? Getting quality information about what's going on in your community is a public good. And we're just going to say that there's a certain amount of money that gets allocated for every congressional district based on population. And there's going to be like a local paper that ends up being the beneficiary of this, or like a local station or whatever, like the local organs are. And it could be public, private, you know, it could even be in some cases philanthropic, but that there are different approaches. These media organizations could 100% exist if they weren't forced to throw off market level profits every given quarter. Mm-hmm. So what do I mean by that? It's like, look, my local paper can't compete. But if you had a combination public-private and you had a paper that made a certain amount of money and then spent that much money on coverage and it broke even every year, obviously no one would invest in that because, you know, it's a terrible business. But as the public, would you invest in that? Probably. I mean, you'd put it in place and then at least you don't have to and in my mind, it would be worth the subsidy. I have no problem with subsidizing local journalism. And I also think, Sagar, this is a fundamental issue, and this is where I possibly, and I think I'm clear-headed about this, genuinely. This is probably where you and I disagree. Well, conservatives look up and say, hey, you can't have government involved with local media because it'll become politicized and a bargaining chip, and they might influence coverage, et cetera, et cetera. And then I look at it and say, okay, the current situation is literally zero. Improve on zero? And if you have issues around politicization and the rest of it, you can look around the world and say, look, are there independent media organizations that are publicly funded that seem like they're okay criticizing the government? And you would find, yes, they do exist. You know, you could hold up the BBC as one potential example and say that, is it perfect? No, but does it exist? And do a lot of people get value from it? And like, does it seem fairly independent journalistically and able to critique leaders? Yeah, sure. And so the correct approach is not, in my opinion, just throw up your hands and say, can't do it. Like, government's going to screw it up somehow. Instead, you have to get into the weeds of it and say, look, like the current path is leading towards, in this case, total absence of local journalism, which I would argue is very disastrous for democracy. So then you have to just put your hard hat on and roll up your sleeves and say, okay, what are the issues we're concerned about? You don't want politicians being able to yank funding every time that the news organization says something nasty about them. Well, then, like, let's see if we can make this funding mechanism independent of Congress's whims. Maybe you have like very long time frames, or you can only make changes like X years in advance when you know, like it might not matter to you anyway.
Right.
So. Like that to me is like a more principled approach. But this is the tough truth as someone who, and it's fun because I know some people like me because they think I have some libertarian impulses and leanings and whatnot. I am very conscious of the fact that there are a lot of things, in my opinion, government is terrible at, and you'd rather not have them involved with it. But there's also this tough truth that we're in an era where you're going to need government at a minimum to inject resources into certain types of institutions or to solve certain types of problems, because there's so many problems we have that the market will not have any interest in solving.
So I actually completely agree with you. And, you know, people, you know, who know me know that it's not about the government intervention necessarily that I'm most concerned about. It's actually that I'm not so sure that we don't have a private sector solution. And the reason I say that is because I look at somebody like you who was born, like I said, with the Joe Rogan of the internet. I see this burgeoning alternative media ecosystem. I see Substack. I see what's happening in Silicon Valley with tech and so much more. The explosion of new businesses and more. And I say, you know what? There's something going on here. There's a realignment, so to speak, right? And maybe there's...
What does the realignment stand for? Is realignment politics or...
It's everything. That's the thing is, originally it kind of began as politics. We were like, oh, well, there's this realignment where, I mean, at the most basic sense, it was, Obama voters then going to vote for Trump, like in the political level. Clearly something happened there, changing political coalitions. Then we started talking about it with Bernie, all this crossover between Bernie Sanders voters and Trump voters. Same with your candidacy, which is why I was kind of obsessed with, because you ran and you had 42% of Trump voters who were supporting a Democrat for the presidential nominee. Clearly, there's a cross-cutting message there, which is happening. But the thing is, the more you look at it, you have changing business, you know, changing media landscape, changing business landscape, you're changing political coalitions. It's like the craziest election in a long, maybe crazier than the one before that. So I kind of apply it as a framework towards everything. And that's what I mean when I say I look at the media, and I know you're involved in the tech space as well. I see this explosion of Substack. I see this explosion of independent journalists, guys like Matt Taibbi, Joe Rogan going to Spotify, the emergence of this whole new culture. And I'm like, what it's really up to is entrepreneurs and others is to find a way in order to make that work for local news. And if that actually cannot work, if we truly cannot work, I'm not above the public solution whatsoever. It's more about jumping towards that a little bit too quickly, if that makes sense.
It can't work, brother. You know, the numbers guy has looked at it and said, this is a total disaster. And when companies have invested tens of millions in it, you remember Patch?
Yeah, I do.
You know, like it was just setting money on fire. The local papers have all become, desiccated husks or disappeared. And I walked through those offices because I was campaigning in rural Iowa and New Hampshire and elsewhere. And so you go interview with a local paper. And guess what that office looks like now? It's half empty, and you know, people are looking around wondering if they're going to survive. And that's pre-pandemic. I mean, post-pandemic, the stuff's even worse. Can you imagine being like a free weekly in Austin or Boston or wherever trying to survive now? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Like I'm sure that there is no entrepreneurial market-based solution for local journalism, unless you were to have something like universal basic income where people had their needs met, and then if they wanted to, they could write about stuff. But even then, you would have certain types of journalism that were not included in that because like a local blog is not the same as having a genuine news organization.
So, well, this is interesting. So what's your framework for looking at it? Because I think I remember you supporting Democracy Dollars. Would it be somewhere in the same vein whenever it comes to media? Would it be like you give X amount of money to folks, kind of like a UBI, and then say that you have to spend X amount as on a subscription to a journalist or a publication that you want? Or is it that we would decide which publications exist?
Yeah, I'd like to give people essentially media dollars or journalism dollars. And even then, unfortunately, I don't think it would necessarily solve all of your problems. And so I think we would need to subsidize local journalism still, because if I gave you media dollars, you might use it on a bunch of podcasters, and then there still might not be none. but that is the general approach, because one of the problems with our media coverage is that one, and here's the thing I want you to know, Sagar, and you're it's hard for you to know this because you're still up and coming. But all of the people you and I see are already at like the top of the pyramid. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yourself included. You know, it's like if you say like, oh, well, we, you know, scrappy podcasts can like make this stuff work and whatnot. It's like, yeah, some people can, you know, but it's not a replacement for what we're eliminating. It's a little bit like, you know, like Amazon to retail or whatever. It's like, you know, you're going to get rid of whatever 10 million mall jobs, and then you're going to end up with like 800,000 Amazon employees. You're going to get rid of a million local journalists, and then you'll have like 100,000 podcasters, like only 20,000 of whom can like buy health insurance. whatever it is. So the numbers don't end up subbing out for each other. There's like, actually the big problem I see is that we're also conditioned to just this sort of make it work positive market mentality that you'll see people making arguments based upon, like, we'll adapt. Like yeah. It's okay. You can go to some local newspaper and they'll be like, we'll adapt. And you'd be like, you all are fucked. You know, it's like there's like, you know, that I mean, that's like, I've actually now seen that's one of the things that's driving us to distress, is like there's this disintegration of people's situations, but then they're being forced to put on brave faces. I've had so many conversations that resemble that. And the issue really is that we have this system-wide fabric that is tearing in various ways, and we're not able to mend it. And our organizations can't even really talk about it because it's not what they're measuring.
I think you're right. And I absolutely agree, which is that, you know, hustle porn is kind of like what I like to call it. Like, hustle porn is not a substitute for like safety net or a government society, which will actually ensure that the way that you can live your life is prosperous or not. And I think that that's actually a really key point, which is the way I kind of see it is that after 2008, we basically pushed economic risk down to the individual. Like, we de-risked the corporate sector, we de-risked, you know, the financial sector and so much more. And it became incumbent upon others like you and me. Well, actually, you're right. You know, we're already at the top, so to speak. It came incumbent upon everyone in order to have a little bit of risk and then also bear a lot of the brunt of that, which I don't think is really fair economically. But that kind of brings me to an interesting thing here, which is that you've kind of zeroed in on local news as a specific where the government has to specifically prop this thing up, even if we were to give people media dollars and I might go spend it on my podcasters, so to speak. It runs a little counter to UBI and the way that you look at it. Because I think one of the reasons that I'd always kind of raised questions about UBI and others had too, which is that how do we know that the money is necessarily going to flow to the sectors of the economy which we know we need to prop up the most or that we consider essential as a nation state? And that's kind of the framework that you are adopting here with media. So I'm curious why it was your signature solution whenever it came to the economy.
And I've seen the folks who are struggling around the country, and I have minimal interest in trying to build up this giant array of new government programs that may reach those 100 million people that just don't care about any of it. You know, you try and talk them into it, being like, no, this will be awesome for you. And they're just like, I still believe very confidently that putting resources into people's hands would be the best way to actually address any of the other goals that you're trying to address, be it entrepreneurship or small businesses, healthcare, education, our political polarization. Putting in money into people's hands would be helpful for all of it. And one of the frustrations I think we're having, and this is from the math too, it's like if you increase everyone's costs by 200 to 250% gradually over time, and you don't increase their income in a real way, you know, and they look around being like, why can I not send my kid to college anymore without taking out like giant debt? Like, why is daycare so crazy expensive? Like, why are we getting hooked on these opiates while people profit to billions of dollars from our addiction? No, they're just looking around saying, this is getting worse and worse for me. And the thing that I was so... I still get angry about is that like there's a lot of like, well, it's somehow your fault, you know, and it's like, no, actually, it's the fact that we have allowed our system to become so inhuman and so tilted towards the almighty dollar and the corporations that make the dollars, as opposed to just the average young man trying to make it, or the, you know, mom trying to figure out how to provide a decent life. It makes me really sad and angry. And then if you look to try and solve that, the best thing that you could do is put money in their hands. And then the money would end up guiding many of our institutions and many of our companies toward trying to serve their needs better. And this is one thing that frustrates me about a lot of people. It's like you look up and you're like, okay, things have gotten demented over the last, let's call it 40 years. One example, you know, might be, I mean, yeah, you know, freaking just pick an example. There are people who want to fix it that just seem to be casting about for different solutions from the past. And it's like they think that we can dial back time itself to 1980 or that it's like there's like right. a time machine. It's like, no, you know, it's 2020. You look around, the economy's turned on more and more of us and turned us against each other. And we're all getting stuck like rats in a maze. You know, you get money into people's hands and then it ends up alleviating a lot of this. And there were these people who, like, I was shocked, Sagar, when I ran. I thought I'd be like the, you know, the guy who was even more radical than Bernie or whatnot. Like, you know, it's like even Bernie didn't take it this far. Uh-huh. But instead, I wound up attracting a totally different group of people, which I still find very invigorating and exciting. But there were people like me and maybe to some extent you where you're like, oh, this is like a different approach to things. Like, this person seems more interested in what the facts are on the ground. And he doesn't really want to waste any time like attacking, you know, like someone, be it. And what Van says, it's either immigrants or billionaires, depending upon which part of the spectrum you're on. It's like, right. I actually don't have that much of an interest in throwing rocks at anybody. Like, I'm just saying, look, here's a situation. It's terrible for many, many people. It was terrible pre-pandemic. Here's how we can fix it. I'm curious on your side, because I regard you as an intelligent conservative. I feel like if I was an intelligent conservative, you know, that I'd have deep misgivings about the current direction of the Republican Party. But there's this tough sense of, of the fact that not many people have been living up to the true ideals of conservatism in my mind.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I also think that it's about the way that we think about the word conservatism itself. I mean, the truth is, conservatism, in my view, has, I mean, I also have to tell these libertarians, actually, I don't have a lot in common with you. I think it's been hijacked by libertarianism over the last 30 years. And if you look at what we're trying to conserve, or what is conservative, or what does it even mean to pursue economic conservative policy, most people, unfortunately, would say, oh, they're for debts, deficits, and better spending in government. And it's like, well, in my view, economic conservatism should be using economic policy to achieve conservative ends. And when I mean that, what I mean by that is, I want to make it easier for people to get married and have kids in this country. And the number one reason in 2018 that we had the lowest marriage rate of all time was the number one reason that people cited was not having the funds. Not, you know, irreligiosity, secularization, any of that, which is something that is erroneously blamed by, in my view, like libertarian conservatives on. They try to blame people when in reality it's what you're talking about. It's the cruelty of an economic system which makes it so that you are not living up and making the choices that you want to make. I fundamentally believe also in trusting people. And I think that by trusting people that they will choose almost generally in order to take and make choices that are best for them, which also align kind of what I mean when I say economic conservatism. Now, in terms of the Republican Party, I mean, I do. Sorry, go ahead.
Now, I'm incredibly excited that that's the way you frame the challenge, because I agree that's the challenge. Is like, to me, if you don't have families, like, what's the point? And, yeah. You know, like, I'm a dad. And I agree with you that it should be a giant red flag to all of us if you have the lowest marriage rates because of economic insecurity, the lowest childbearing rates because of economic insecurity. Yes. You talk to a young person and they look up and say, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to settle down and get married and have a kid because I can barely like pay off my debt and keep a roof over my head and like, you know, and just be able to do my make work stuff to make ends meet. And I think that to me right now, our goal should just be human flourishing. And I agree with you that most all the time, the best way to have people flourish is to put the agency in their hands, and let them make their own decisions.
Yeah. I mean, and that's part of my, when you said deep misgivings, I think I get what you want, but I want to flip it on its head. My issue is that what I saw in Trump, what a lot of people on my side saw, was this person opening the door and kicking over all of the people who define kind of conservatism in the way that I was talking about, in defining it as the love of free markets, very much like a Mitt Romneyism 2012, makers and takers, and demonizing really people who have been crushed by a neoliberal economic system. And so whenever I have my misgivings, like we're right now, you and I are talking in the midst of the RNC, My misgiving is that I see the GOP straying away even farther over the last 4 years, kind of since the day that Trump won and the RNC kind of took it over, and you had these traditional conservative elements, and he didn't actually live up as much to the worker promises that he made during his campaign. And similarly here at the RNC, that to me, what I want it to be is much more like that 2016 campaign. Like, I was watching some clips of Hillary Clinton, you know, defending NAFTA and talking about, you know, jobs. And I know that it, in your view, it doesn't always align with trade, but really what it actually came down to, it's not about trade versus automation, although you can discuss that. It's about compassion for not lecturing these people and saying that your life is better because we get, you know, your job left here and your life is still better, or your job left here and it's now on you to move to an ex-urban, you know, suburb and live in a smaller town. I mean, the truth is, I can't remember which study I was seeing this, is again kind of comes back to economic conservatism for me, which is localism. You know, a lot of people really enjoy where they're from and they want to live near their mom and their grandparents, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Saying you have to move is a terrible recipe that would get rocks thrown at you in many, many American towns, and deservedly so. I mean, to me, if you're in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, it should not be that you have to uproot yourself and your family to live a decent life. Now, should we be encouraging dynamism? Yes. You know, but should we make it so that if you choose not to move, you die? No.
Exactly. Right. Or get hooked on opioids. Or, and this comes down to monopolization. This is another something I'm really interested in, which is that one of the most pernicious things that somebody told me, I won't name him because he's high level in economics, but he said, you know, I'm unconvinced that the best scenario for Amazon is not 10% unemployment, or, you know, perma 10 to 15% unemployment. And the reason being that if you're in a rural or a small town, that the best paying job, so to speak, and really the only option for you, is to work in an Amazon warehouse at a very set wage, which is non-unionized. And there is a level of, you know, corporate control there over the way that you're conducting your life and your, you know, your singular option of being able to live, that I do think is unacceptable. How have you always looked at the monopolization question? Because I know you toyed with it, you know, between tech and then the regular sector too.
I don't think we have truly reckoned with what it means to have trillion-dollar companies that dominate so much of our waking life. You know, and it was, to me, a source of great amusement watching these trillion-dollar companies pretend to be scrappy startups in front of Congress the other week. It was like, right. Oh, you know, we're not number one at all. You know, we could be upended any day by those TikTokers or whatever. Right, it's like, we wouldn't have crushed Instagram. No. Like, you know, it's like the whole thing. It's like, oh, gosh. Like watching them try and recast themselves. The consequences of having companies of that scale are unknown to us, but they're extreme. And one of the things I kept saying to folks is like, look, at this point, Amazon no longer has to obey the rules of business physics anymore. It's just like this voracious black hole.
Yes. Literally,
You know, it's like it could decide not to make money in a given quarter and it would still be a trillion-dollar company. You can't compete with them in any meaningful way. They have essentially unlimited resources and access to more data than anyone else. You know, that like they'll trumpet the fact that they're hiring tens of thousands of Americans while retail is shutting down. And I mean, made light of it earlier about what's going to happen. So the old toolkit would be like, well, break them up. And I think that there needs to be a breakup of some of these companies in some verticals. But I also don't think that actually solves the problem, because you wind up with still these network effects that just advantage whatever company is at the hub. And right now, our government is so bad at this, where we're essentially 25 years behind the curve. So any company that's come into existence over the last 25 years, we're like, don't know what you're doing. And then we have this mistrust of government being like, well, you're slow and behind the times, and they're really smart and ahead of the times. they should decide what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the ways we're conditioned. So the optimal path would be that we go to each of the big four or five companies and just say, look, we have company specific issues with you. Trying to apply a one size fits all antitrust framework doesn't even make sense.
Right.
Like we're going to have to craft tailored legislation and figure out what the worst aspects of your enormity are and then circumscribe them. So in Facebook's case, it might be like, well, what are our biggest beefs with you? The erosion or near decimation of our democracy, I would say, would be the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that they sell and resell us and our data for tens of billions of dollars a year might be second. And then the third might be the fact that they have a near monopoly on certain types of social media because they did buy Instagram and WhatsApp. And so maybe we have to do something about that. And then there might be mental health of our kids associated with Instagram use. You go down the list and just try and figure out what each issue is. Like, I'm not against size for size's sake. I'm against size if it ends up hurting us in various mm-hmm. ways. And then you'd have to write company-specific legislation for Facebook. Essentially, don't pretend it's like we're going to take out a 20th century framework before the internet even existed, back when they were talking about, picking yeah. like, this company makes too much steel. Yeah, yeah, like it's a very, very different world now.
Yeah, I think it's funny you said that. What I always loved about your campaign was the feeling that I wasn't living in ossified Washington. You know, like, because I've covered these guys on Capitol Hill and so much more, and it was, I'll never forget him being like, why does my iPhone listen to me? And I was like, all right. Like, when you're going up to Mark Zuckerberg and you're asking, how does Facebook make money? It's like, okay, I mean, you just waste, you have a finite amount of time whenever you get to ask questions here. It used to drive me absolutely nuts. I'm actually curious how it's been for you as you have gone from this anti-establishment figure to, like, now you're a CNN commentator. Now you're a mainstream, I mean, I would call you a mainstream figure in the Democratic Party, or at least a established one. So how has it been, like, how have your ideas been received? Because we talked about on the show at the time, like, at first they would laugh at you, then they would see you pass them in the polls, then they would drop out and you would still be on the stage, and then you would outraise them, then you would outpoll them, and it was kind of a fun cycle. At what point did they start to take you seriously? And even now, now that the campaign is over, in what way, how do they engage with your ideas? Is it with sincerity, or is it with like goofy ideas?
No. Politicians respond to their own incentives. And so politicians will be nice to you if, for example, you have a mailing list of a million people and they know that you can potentially be of value to them. So the goal has to be that we end up showing people that these ideas are right, but also that it's in their interest to embrace these ideas because it's good for them politically, and it's bad for them politically if they don't. That's just the way that their incentives run. In terms of how I'm currently received, folks are constantly congratulating me on the race, the campaign. And at this point, 55% of Americans are for universal basic income, and something like 76% are for cash relief.
Yep.
So most people know that the ideas are right at this point. The question is, to your earlier inquiry, how the heck do you actually have the will of the people enacted by our legislators? And that is what I'm tasked with right now, is figuring out how to rebuild that connection and make it so that not only can we all know what the right thing to do is, but that our lawmakers actually pass it. I'll say, Sagar, it's like, I agree with you that I have gone from being something of a fringe figure to a mainstream figure. By virtue of the math, it's mm-hmm. like, if you have a big enough following, then you can't really even define yourself as not part of like the mainstream. So thank you, Yang Gang. And thank you to everyone who made that happen. You individually too, Sagar, for always being intellectually genuine and receptive. But I still don't think that like I'm considered part of the establishment in many respects, I would say. Certainly not the political establishment. I don't live in DC. I don't know a lot of the people. So, from my perspective, frankly, I was running and then the race ended and then COVID hit and I've just been in my study. So it's hard to determine how fundamental the transformation has been.
Well, so tell me, what's your theory of the case on how change is made? I mean, one of the ones, and this is an Elizabeth Warren point, but I've believed this for a long time. I've studied the New Deal, you know, Civil Rights Act, so much more, like how this stuff actually all came to pass. At the end of the day, a lot of it was what you referenced earlier, earmarks, horse trading, and personnel, more than anything. It was having like a committed 100 to 1,000 people who were well-versed in your ideology that were able, and also qualified, like well-educated, qualified, all of that, they were able to come in and kick the door in on day one. Whenever people ask me why the Trump presidency didn't live up to its working ideals, that's my response, which is that, look, the establishment is the establishment for a reason. They've got all the lawyers, they've got, you know, the RNC, they've got these people who are like very versed in their ideology, they're very good at it, they've been doing the same thing administration after administration after administration, they've got programs, they've got the Federalist Society, they've got all these, what I call them, are credentialing institutions. And, you know, when you're a nascent political movement, kind of how I consider like the new right, you're just not going to have that. And I'm curious, like, how have you seen, because you, like you're saying, you know, UBI could be at 50, it could be at 100% approval rating. But if people on Capitol Hill don't take it seriously, then it's not going anywhere. And it's one of the most frustrating parts. How do you think that that can be solved? I mean, do you even agree with that? Like, how do you think that you can?
Oh, I agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, we need members of Congress who ran on it and who embrace it. And then you need to show other members of Congress that being for it is better than being not for it. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you need the blessings of some establishment think tanks and whatnot to say, yeah, this makes sense and this would work. But I agree with you. You need to cross each of those bridges to try and get it across the finish line.
Yeah, and I think that that's such an important... That's something I try and make my listeners understand is I'm like, what you want doesn't actually matter. Unless, like, you have the infrastructure in DC in order to actually make that happen. So, last thing here, Andrew, I asked my followers, I asked a lot of people, I said, what should I ask Andrew Yang? The number one question that they wanted to know was why you support Biden. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk about it.
No, running for president, you do get to know the various candidates. And I think given the nature of your audience, it's why do I support Biden versus Trump, I suppose, seems to be the question. And I just don't think Trump has the right qualities to govern. Just think he's like a narcissist who doesn't have the makeup, doesn't have the right makeup. And I think that... So I'm not someone that... Like, there are some people who... who disagree with the fact that American institutions have been failing the American people for a long time. I think this is something you and I have in common and many Trumpers have in common. I 100% believe that many of our institutions have been failing us for quite some time and that we have been waking up to that increasingly. Now, I think that certain Americans have woken up to it more than others. Mm. There are some Americans who think that things are working just fine. and I'm not one of them. And it's one reason why, you know, I think that there has been a gap between me and certain other people. But I just don't think that Trump is the figure you bring in to make the right kind of changes. And I don't see eye to eye with Joe on everything. But having gotten to know Joe, I think he's a fairly non-ideological, pragmatic guy who wants to try and find the best path forward. He'll have really good people with and around him. And he's the best shot we have at trying to actually get into the roots of some of these problems. Now, speaking forthrightly, I ran for president, so I thought that I would be a great choice. But, you know, if you give me a choice between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, it's going to be Joe. Every day of the week.
Pretty utilitarian, but I think a very fair case to make. Anyway, Andrew, I really appreciate you joining the podcast and letting me on your podcast, man. It was a great discussion. Thank you.
Oh, Sagar, it's a pleasure, man. Yeah. And thank you for being one of the journalists who always had like a real air of curiosity and intellectual openness to my campaign. Like that's something, maybe it's your relative youth, or maybe the fact that you're, you know, Asian American as well, where you saw, and it's like, huh, like, or maybe just that you like facts and figures. I actually appreciated your critique. One of the things you wrote in your book about me was like, hey, is Andrew Yang right about automation or is it trade? Like, I lean more towards globalization, but, you know, like, this is the kind of conversation you should be having as opposed to the other nonsense. Like that was actually one of the most disciplined journalistic responses to my campaign that I saw, because, and that was one of the things that scared the shit out of me, is like people are having the usual argument of symbols, and then I come on the scene and I'm like, hey, here's some facts and figures.
Yep.
And the level of journalistic inquiry into my facts and figures was so low, where like there weren't many people being like, is this right? Like, did we indeed get rid of 5 million manufacturing jobs? Like, yes. Like, what was the composition? Like, you actually went the step to say, like, what was the cause of the loss of 5 million manufacturing jobs? And you were like, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Certainly, it's like a combination of these things. Like, most journalists did not seem to care to actually engage on that. And then you have to ask yourself, wait a minute. Like, let's say I just change the number. Let's say instead of, like, we lost 5 million manufacturing jobs, we lost 10.
Yeah.
12. Like, at what point does it matter? To you? Yeah. And to most journalists, like, it could be any number and it just does not matter. Like, they're not actually cataloging the progress of our way of life. They're cataloging something else. And that's what we have to change.
I think you're absolutely right, Andrew, which is that cataloging the day-to-day kind of ins and outs palace intrigue of Washington is not even close to cataloging trade, automation, the very way that we structure, live our lives.
Our standard of life. To me, it's all about how healthy are we? How mentally healthy are we? How are our kids doing? How is our family formation rate? That would be probably like a very positive indicator. Like, how addicted to substances are we? How optimistic are we? How dynamic are we culturally, economically? Are people starting businesses? You know, to me, small businesses are the life's blood of so many communities. And if you have everyone just showing up to work at Amazon, like, that's kind of terrible. That's sort of dystopian. Yeah. You know, at some point, Amazon should just start assigning us overalls and say, like, hey, here are your Amazon overalls. It's the American way. It's got a big A on the front. You know, we could be the United States of Amazon. They could, like, take over the flag. Maybe if they pay enough, they could freaking sponsor our flag. I've gotten very dark and dystopian, but yeah,
dystopian.
These are to me like the right. You had some of the right questions, and you engaged with them more rigorously than most any other journalist I saw. Honestly,
thank you, Andrew. Really appreciate that. Appreciate you joining us, man. Thank you.
No problem, Sagar. It's great talking to you.
You too. All right, we hope you guys enjoyed that episode. As always, thank you to our sponsor, the Lincoln Network. Next up on Thursday, we are going to have Zed Jelani, frequent friend and guest from Rising. He's going to join us to talk about everything that's going on with the riots, with looting, with policing, how we can live in a more egalitarian society. Zed is probably one of the most interesting figures in American politics today. I basically find myself agreeing with 95% of his takes on everything. I'm really excited to bring him to all of you.
And we will see you guys on Thursday.